Log Talk Radio.
It's the Morning Show.
Okay, you want to rehearse it one time before we go in there?
With award-winning journalist Cheryl Smith.
I'm good. I'm not that good.
Bringing you informative, enlightening, thought-provoking, inspiring, and entertaining talk radio.
Good morning, everyone. Showing you a few headlines from the three publications produced by iMessenger Media, where the publisher is Cheryl Smith, and here is her column where she gives her insights on events. Let me shut this door. And continue to greet you. Let me explain my mask. I always tell you about my mask. I'm determined to respect the protocol, the health protocol of the health officials about wearing masks, using sanitizer, keeping your social distance and all of that. But since I'm, I am in a building with other people, but since I'm in a room by myself, I am going to remove it if I can get it off. And then when I go back out, I will put it back on. But I just, you know, I just believe in respecting the health issues. The people who talk about their personal rights, well, we stop at red lights. We get our kids inoculated for school. There are a number of people who ride motorcycles, wear helmets. Yeah, they didn't want to do it at first. But we respect laws and we keep certain speed limits on thoroughfares and freeways and what have you. If we felt like speeding, we wish we could just go tearing down the freeway 90 miles an hour, but we respect the laws. And so why can't we do that? I mean, why put personal desires above the good of the majority? Why do that? So at any rate, that's my whole argument about wearing a mask. I'm excited about our guest today, and I believe we've got a couple of other people who will probably join us later. Let me tell you, and you know what? Did I tell you that you are watching? I was just thinking, and that I am your host, Norma Adams Wade, and I always like to remind you that you are my co-host, because listen here, I'm old school, so all of this social media technology, much of it is over my head, so I am so grateful to have young technicians around the building here who can assist me. So I have hired you, viewers and listeners, to be my co-host and help me concentrate on how to get through all of this technology, and I appreciate you for it. My guest today is, well, she's an outstanding, high-achieving educator. Her name is Dr. Helen Benjamin. I'm going to go ahead and bring her in while I tell you about her, and I'm just going to say hello, and then I'll tell you about her. Hello, Dr. Helen Benjamin.
Good morning.
Can you hear me okay?
Oh, very well.
And I can hear you fine. Great. Okay. Dr. Helen Benjamin is a retired chancellor of the Contra Costa Community College District on the West Coast. And she has held a number of high-level positions in education. She has been an interim president of a West Coast college. She has been the president of a college there, and then she was chancellor, and then she retired, and they needed her, and they begged her, and she came back, and right now she is chancellor again. She has told them, this is just for a short time now, y'all can use my talents while you need me, but this is just for a short time, and then she wants to go back into retirement. She has a doctorate from Texas Women's University, a master's from Texas Women's University, a Bachelor of Science in English and Spanish. Guess where? Bishop College. Yes, 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 our own Bishop College, which originally was in Marshall. And so we're just delighted to have her, and we will introduce. Let me go ahead and bring in another guest. And this is, can you hear me, Emma Jones Gray? Can you hear me? Let's see. She might not be able to hear me. Emma Jones Gray, can you hear me? Let's see here. We may have to work on, is your sound muted? Oh, okay, I know. Is your microphone muted? Let's see. I think I hear somebody else coming in. Try to see if your mic is on. It's on here. Okay. Can't hear it? Okay. Let's see. Well, I don't want to. Let me try one thing with my young assistant here. Let me see if she can. But she cannot hear me. She's on, but she can't hear me. It's okay for them to see you. It's all right. Because my first lady can hear me fine. She can't hear me.
What about resending her the links?
Nah, I'm not going to try it because I'm just going to go ahead and talk with my first lady.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah, let me just ask her
to exit on and come back.
Okay. All right. Okay. Can we send her a message on the thing, on the chat? As they exit out and come back in?
It's not working.
And she's Miss Gray.
Okay. Is that, hopefully it's not on here. Wait, is it on your Facebook live? I think it might be.
Okay, well, let me go on with the first lady.
Okay.
Okay, Dr. Benjamin, can you still hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, Dr. Benjamin, can you still hear me?
Yes.
Okay, well, we're going to go ahead and we sent a message to Miss Gray. I can hear you. Miss Gray, I can hear you. Can you hear Miss Gray? You still can't hear me? Okay. Well, anyway.
I'll be back.
Okay. All right. Okay. So let me show the audience, and I've got all kind of markers and stuff, but this is the book that we're going to talk about, and the book is How We Got Over, and this book was edited and it was edited by Dr. Helen Benjamin and co-edited by a good friend of hers and mine. We know each other also, Jean Nash Johnson. She and I used to work together at a major media. And so we're going to talk about this book today. But Dr. Benjamin, go ahead and tell us good morning.
Good morning. It's good to be here. Thanks for having us.
Oh, you are so welcome. You are so welcome. So in your, let's start this way while we're waiting on Miss. Let me see if I can. We're gonna get this done. Okay. So okay, go ahead in your own words. Tell us what the book is about. How we got over. What is that about?
What is that about? Well, the complete title is How We Got Over Growing Up in the Segregated South, mm-hmm. A Collection of Narratives.
Okay.
So it's a project that, and I'm calling it a project because that's what it became. I was in a training for diversity, equity, and inclusion back in October of 2020. And the trainer was talking about redlining and its impact on Black people and why it was done. And she was just describing the kinds of redlined neighborhoods, which mm-hmm. I'm sure you're familiar with.
Right, right.
Railroad tracks running through and where Black people live and all the undesirable elements surrounding them. And it just catapulted me into my own path growing up in Alexandria, Louisiana, surrounded by of course, railroad tracks and sawmills and processing plants and all these things.
Right.
And it hadn't struck me before in my life the way it struck me that day. And I just immediately, this idea came to my mind that this experience that I'd had needed to be recorded and preserved, that people needed to know about it. Not that no one else had ever written about it, but from the point of view of people who really lived it, and I thought about my classmates.
Yeah.
We graduated from Peabody High School in 1968, and then I thought, well, I'll get in touch with them and see if they're interested, and it was amazing. They were all just the ones I contacted. Of course, I thought I knew it would be a major undertaking, and so Jean Nash Johnson, whom you mentioned, is married to one of my classmates.
Okay.
And I knew, she's from Lake Charles, not from our hometown.
Okay.
But I knew that Jean, of course, had a writing background and I would need somebody to help me. So I ran the idea by her immediately.
Right.
She thought it was great. And then another one of my classmates who had started our scholarship fund for our class, Reverend Larry Smith, I called him to see if he'd help me identify some people. And he said yes. And we were just off and running. And Emma, of course, who's with her, and Reverend Emil Jones is supposed to be with us today, too. I don't know what's up with him.
Right.
But they just all immediately said yes.
Okay, now let me ask you this. All right, you had this epiphany, I'll call it, an emotional epiphany,
very
I understand.
Emotional.
Yeah. And then you thought, you know, somebody should record this. So I can only imagine, as they say in that song, I can only imagine your nights with this idea running through your mind, and then at some point you did make the decision, you know what, I'm going to contact my classmates and see if we can put this book together. But I'm wondering, when you first started reaching out to people, did you think, okay, I'll get three or four people will decide to come with me, and I'll be good with the three or four? Was that the way, or did you really believe you were going to have, you know, more than a dozen?
It was fully formed. When it was fully formed in my head, I had, the title came to me all in that moment, How We Got Over. I thought about Clara Ward. I knew she had written it. And then Aretha Franklin and Mahalia Jackson, of course, had sung it. I love both versions.
Right,
so
right.
It all just came. I never had any doubt that it wouldn't happen.
Right.
And it just happened. There's some what I consider almost miraculous things that happened in the process, but I wasn't all that surprised, I don't think.
that's amazing. That's amazing. That it was fully formed. And like you said, the song came to you. I think the song is How I Got Over.
How I, and
I know the audience has heard that and rejoiced with it. And it's such a telling message in that song and in the title of the book that you call How We, meaning you and your classmates.
Classmates.
Right.
And not only the larger we, Black people.
Oh, yes. What a great point. What a great point. Because, because you and your classmates a sort of a microcosm, I guess we could say, of our people, of our total experience. That's a great point, great point. And I think you answered my next question, but I'm wondering, did the message you wanted to convey change in any way as you went on through the process of editing it? Or did, like you say, it was fully formed in your mind from the beginning? Or did the message tweak itself any along the way, or what?
It became amplified, I think, in just the repetition of in the stories. And then when I got to the point where we had all the stories,
uh-huh.
and then I wrote people and said, I need you to give me a quote to go at the beginning of your story
right.
to reflect your content.
Right.
And all these quotes started coming in, and 85% of them were scriptures. Which goes back to the how I got over time.
Oh, my gosh.
And that means that we were sustained by our faith.
Right. Now, I thought I heard Miss Gray. Say something, Miss Gray.
Yes. Oh, testing.
I can hear you.
Can you hear me now?
I can hear you, and you can hear us? Right.
Yes.
Oh, wonderful, 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 wonderful. Great. Okay, since we can hear you and you can hear us, this is Emma Jones Gray. And you are a classmate of Dr. Benjamin. So I want you, now, let's see, let me try to find your part in the book. Okay.
Chapter 15.
Okay, let me see if I can hold up. Okay, let's see. Okay, this is your part in the book. Let's see if I can. Okay, There's you in the early days and then you now. Okay.
Right.
Okay. And your part is my journey empowered by his grace and favor. What did you mean by that, and how did you approach your part of the book?
Yes, empowered by his grace and favor, because as I look back and did some reflection on my life and how many times and how often I could not have been here.
Mm.
And I know it was God's grace and favor that brought me here.
Give us one of those examples. I think you talked about them in the book of some close calls you had. Give us one of those.
Absolutely.
And at what age?
The one that's vivid is when I was about 3 years old, 3 or 4 years old, playing with the matches.
Oh, my God. Let me slap your hand.
Absolutely. And they thought they'd hidden them. They did what they were supposed to do, put them up high somewhere.
Right.
But I was a little ball brat. I watched. And I was told not to do something. And my dad went to the store, the corner store, and said, stay in bed while they go to the store. But no, I get up and plaid my hair in the Dixie Peach. Back in the day, you either a Royal Crown person or a Dixie Peach.
I was Royal Crown.
You know, all right. we were the Dixie Peach, and I just played in that and in the mirror, and then I decided I was the queen and going to light a match and use that as, because I saw queens wore a crown and it was lit, right, in my little mind.
Yes. Sparkling, yeah.
Yes, it was sparkly. Mm-hmm. And, of course, when that match burns down and you have it at the top of your head, you're going to drop it. And so that could have been a tragedy. And
oh,
God
absolutely.
Blessed me to have a community where my brother was there. He was a little older than me. He doused my hair out, but I ran outside. The neighbor, the community, mm-hmm. I ran outside. She saw the smoke from my hair.
Oh, my gosh.
She heard me screaming. That could have been, and look at me now.
Yes.
Could have been burned in the face. I only have a little, maybe a quarter size.
Amazing.
You know, there.
Amazing.
That's amazing, his grace and his favor.
Okay.
That's,
and so the point of your insertion in the book was how you were brought through these type of experiences. Would you say that sort of summarizes?
And that's some, and a close call being Little Miss Rosa Parks. You'll see that. You'll hear that in the book. I could have actually been Miss Rosa Parks.
just give us a little bit of that. Give us a little bit of that, and then
my father always had a car. And so that was just one occasion, though, I rode the bus with my mom downtown. As we got on the bus, she opened her handkerchief with all the change in it that she kept, and I can hear it going in the coin machine because I had not rode the bus before.
Right.
About what age?
Roughly.
I was maybe by this time, maybe about six.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Uh-huh.
And after she put the coin in, and I'm in tow, of course, but she went straight to the back, and I didn't understand that. There's these seats in my mind.
Hello.
I sat in this front seat across from the driver and held on to the pole and smiled and swung my little legs and didn't notice the bus hadn't taken off, and I'm thinking, she missed the seat.
Yes. Come on, Mama. Come up here and sit down.
Right. But after a while, I saw my mother come running up as fast as she could, and she gave what we call the froggy pinch right in your forearm.
Oh, wow.
And she pinched me so hard, and I hopped like a froggy, and I went right behind her. But something tragic could have happened. The
Absolutely.
Bus driver looked at me.
Yeah.
I didn't know he wasn't smiling. I didn't realize that the bus had not taken off.
Wow.
But she never said anything.
Right.
So I just took it. I should have been obedient.
Mm.
And so those kind of things you don't understand because you don't understand what was happening.
Right. Now, Dr. Benjamin, those are two examples of incidents. What was your reaction when you began to read many of these insertions and narratives? What was your reaction or your emotional response to such stories as this?
Yeah, I realized that I did not know much about my classmates. I was shocked by some of the things I read and just moved emotionally by them to the point that I had conversations with all of them, Jean and I did, to the point that I called some and I said, did this happen?
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, or are you, this is the other question, Norma. Are you sure you want to share all of this?
Uh-huh.
This is just so
revealing. Personal. Oh my gosh.
But I think for a lot of the classmates, mm-hmm. it was cathartic.
I bet you.
Have a chance to just really think about and write about. Reflection is so important, I think, for all of us.
Oh, my God.
And that is what the project calls us to do, to be 70 years old and to reflect on our lives. And I had one friend who said, how did you remember all that? And I've always said I have a really bad memory, but
yeah.
I decided that it's not as bad as I thought it was.
Okay.
It was amazing. And I've heard other classmates talk about how things came back to them. And it's for some of us, it became a family project.
Mm.
We were verified things, so other members of the family, people in the neighborhood, and all of that. So I was really surprised. And we did not read each other's stories. Jean and I were the only ones who read all the stories.
Okay.
So the classmates didn't read all the contributors didn't read all the stories until they got their copy of the book. And their reaction was much the same as mine.
Absolutely.
When they read all the stories, it was like, oh my goodness. And I have a first cousin who lives in LA, and she got the book and she called me and we lived across the street from each other growing
right.
up, and she said, I thought we were poor.
Oh.
We were not, comparatively speaking, you know, to some
right.
Of the experience
right.
that other members of the class
right.
had in other neighborhoods, because you don't live in anybody else's house. I mean,
exactly. Exactly.
We draw conclusions. We're living our lives. We have an opinion of what might go on in somebody's house, but you never know because you don't live in that.
I want to ask both of you, and I'll start with Ms. Gray. What do you think was, I won't say significance, but why were African Americans so close in your view? And then I'll ask Dr. Benjamin the same thing. Why were African Americans so close to railroad tracks? Did that occur to you any? Well, what was that about?
Oh, yeah. That was part of the system of relegating you to a certain part of town that they did not want in their part of town.
That was
all part of the system of, you know, showing the inferiority of a people, a black academy of people. That's what that was all about. The chicken portrait, the railroad tracks, the all mill quarters, the iron mills and all of that. Because you're not good enough. So we put these things, you know, on your side of town. But we showed them.
Dr. Benjamin, is your assessment kind of like the same?
Yeah, my assessment is pretty much the same. It's whatever's undesirable.
And in my
research, I discovered there was a very clear plan. Where I lived, where we lived until I was 12 years old, there were four streets between two railroad systems.
Wow.
We had all the Rock Island, I have all the names of them in there, that ran through. We were sandwiched between, and my cousins who lived across the street, their back door was at the railroad track.
My goodness.
Some of the stories, and you know, hobos, we call them. On those trains.
Right.
They would come off those trains when the train would stop, knock on our doors for food, and you know we fed them, don't you?
Oh, I know it. I know. You better.
You know we fed them. But that was all by design. White people needed the services provided by train, but they didn't want the effects of the train.
Okay.
The noise, the hobos.
Right.
You know, and trains run all night long. And you just became accustomed to hearing them. You know, that's what
Pulls
you up after a certain point. That was just part of your daily routine.
Yeah.
But anything that, and all of these things benefited the community in certain ways, but they were out of sight of the people in control.
And you know, that kind of makes me think today of, I think it's still called Section 8, but, you know, there are all kind of community protests when the government wants to build housing for underserved people, and communities that are higher upscale have all kind of resistance meetings. To me, it's kind of very similar to that.
It's very much the same.
Mm-hmm.
They want to keep their neighborhoods pristine.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a street. There was a street that divided the black community from the white community.
Yeah.
And you can believe that the name of that street was Lee Street, as in Robert E. Lee. On one side of that street, primarily black, is pretty much the same today. And on the other side, it was white. The zoo was on the other side and all these beautiful homes.
Amazing.
It was what physically divided us.
Ms. Gray, some of the events of your, the 60s, I guess, and you might can go even back to the 50s. Of course, now, at that age, you were probably not really aware of what was going on in the 60s and what have you. But when, I guess I'll ask you this, when did you begin to put two and two together of your growing up years, your 1968 high school graduation year, and what all was going on in the nation? How did that play out to you? And I'll ask the same thing to Dr. Benjamin.
Yes. I began to kind of become aware. Like I said, the bus incident didn't faze me because I thought, you know, I just needed to be obedient to my mom.
Right. You just thought your mom was tripping.
Right. So, and she never said anything.
Mm.
So, but I think I began to somewhat realize what was happening. My dad was a chef or a short order cook around town.
Okay.
He worked at the famous Bentley Hotel in our town, Alexandria. He worked at the Ramada Inn and all over the place and everything. But he had, I heard one time my mother and my father had a heated debate, I'll say.
Okay.
Because he had quit his job.
Oh, my gosh. She didn't like that.
He had quit his job.
Mm-hmm.
But the controversy was that he was saying to my mom that Maxine, my mother was Maxine.
Okay.
Maxine, I'm not a boy. I'm a man.
Oh, wow.
I'm a man.
Oh, wow.
I'm not a boy.
Oh, wow.
So he felt demeaned.
Yeah, yeah.
And he would quit a job. And she was saying, oh, but Calvin, my dad, but we have five children. We have a hymen we had at the time. But we have four little children. But he said, I'm a man, Maxine.
What a dilemma. What a dilemma.
I began to.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you began?
I began then to see that there's something wrong here.
Yeah.
There's something wrong. That my dad was even with having to be the support of a family, that he felt demeaned, he felt, you know, less than by you calling him a hardworking man, a boy.
But you know what? And Dr. Benjamin, you'll respond, but that plays to me that he made the choice. He made the choice that his personal dignity and self-worth was more important. And I don't mean it in a bad way, but it was significant enough that he drew the line. What do you say, Dr. Benjamin, and some of the other incidents that equated to you?
I think men probably suffered more of the indignity than women did, because then you can see that in some of the stories, just what the men went through as opposed to the women.
Yeah.
Not that women didn't suffer indignity.
Right.
Of segregation.
Right.
But I think there's a point where anybody, you just get to a point where I am not taking this anymore.
Right.
And I think
that's
probably where he got. There's a story in there by Sherman Fulton, and he talks about it. You remember War on Poverty, Lyndon Johnson.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
All these programs, Neighborhood Youth Corps.
Yeah.
And he was in high school. I worked in Neighborhood Youth Corps programs as well. But he tells about, he worked with the city, I guess, and they would cut grass and stuff like this.
Right.
And they had a white supervisor and a bunch of boys. And one day, the white supervisor referred to them as boys.
Ooh.
And they all walked off the job.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, I had no idea this ever happened.
Oh, my goodness.
They all left. And so the director of the program was a wonderful, wonderful man. We called him Dooley. He had done some substitute teaching high schools. And when this program came over, he was in charge. And he knew all of us. And he recruited us individually for the program.
Right.
So Sherman tells the story that Dooley came to his house.
Yeah.
He said, man, I just can't walk off the steps like that. This is 1966 or
67. Oh, gosh.
And Sherman says, he says, well, we'll go back if he stops calling us boys. He doesn't call us boys. But they made a point as teenagers.
Oh, my goodness. That was a, what do you call it, the hint of Black Lives Matter way before,
yes.
You know.
And then you know, we got the news that things were happening and we could go to restaurants and stuff, and they were announcing it at our school.
Okay.
Go and sit at lunch counters and, you know, order food and whatever. So there's stories like that in there.
And let's right there, go ahead and tell me in your mind what was all going on in, like, during that period of time. You graduated in 68.
Right.
And, okay, so tell me, Dr. Benjamin, did anything begin to play out about what was going on in the nation in your mind at the time? And when did it really begin? And name some of the things that you recall, maybe not even recall, but what you learned of later. And put this, you know, that was the year that I graduated from high school. Give me some that.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I was retrospect is a different thing. Living through it, my parents had come from sharecropping families.
Okay.
On Cane River. And so I had spent a lot of summers up there, and I've been in that sharecropping environment. I even went to school there.
Yeah.
When I was in third grade. So I had a sense of, that's as close to kind of slavery as I got, because you know, sharecropping was just another form of slavery.
That's all it was.
My grandmother lived in that environment, ran a farm. My grandfather died. She did it for about 20 years after he died.
Yeah.
She was a lot younger than me. But I have witnessed this. And so to be in Alexandria, what we call in town, where we had brick school buildings and all that, and then to be in the country, what we call the country, in the rural area, where they had one school, a small school, and basically one room, and all the different grades in one room. So I had that experience.
Yeah, yeah.
My grandmother didn't have running water.
Okay.
So I was kind of like two worlds. I experienced this is a different set of indignities in rural areas than in town.
Mm.
You got indignities in town, but it's even worse than
in the rural areas. My.
Really living literally off the land.
Right. Yes.
So I knew, and I could see, and in my separate world, I didn't have interactions with white people at all. It was just a totally different kind of experience.
Mm-hmm.
So to live in that environment and then to start working at, I think my first job was when I was 13 or 14. I babysat for this white family.
Okay.
And then I did NYC work. But I also worked for this white family.
Okay, okay.
I kept their kids. I did two nights a week and on Sunday morning.
Okay, okay.
I had five children.
Wow.
So I could see how they live compared to how I live.
Huh.
But I was kind of, I just see myself now in retrospect, I was just on a mission to get out of that town.
Okay, okay.
We were praying in our house.
Okay.
I don't know what you're going to do when you go to high school, but getting out of here, so I knew I needed to do something.
Right.
All of these things were means to an end for me.
Okay.
I was busy doing work.
You were on a mission. Now, Ms. Gray, I wanted to ask, what were some of the hurdles you had to jump over in writing your narrative? I mean, did you think, oh, this is a piece of cake? And then when you started, it kind of got out of hand. What was the process like for you to really put those experiences down on paper?
Well, I believe writing is one of my gifts.
Okay,
and
good.
To be honest, humbly honest, it was no problem
at all.
I'm a storyteller.
Okay. Griot, you're Griot.
Me and Helen had to, you know, reel me in.
Okay. Wait a minute, hold on. What's that, doctor?
First draft was 48 pages.
I'm a scribe. You got to watch me. I'll tell everything. And I'll change the name to protect the innocent or the guilty.
That's so, funny.
No problem at all. But I want to piggyback on something.
Okay, go ahead.
As to my awakening as to what was really happening.
Yes.
A further awakening was when I would help. I had a friend, and it's not in the book. It didn't make the cut.
Okay, didn't make the cut. Go ahead.
But you know how today we have this, you call the talk. The talk for the Jesus, you know, to, you know, put your hands on the steering wheel. Well, the talk, I had a friend in the neighborhood. I loved to be with the people that were older, and I would sit and talk. So I had a friend named Buddy who lived down the street.
Okay.
Seemed like you can always talk to this person versus your mom.
Right.
And so one time, she was the help for a popular doctor in town.
Uh-huh.
And I guess they were going to throw a party. The doctor's going to have a party. And so Buddy had to come in and do all this stuff.
Right.
And show them what he did. And so she asked my mom, could I come and help her and assist her? And my mother, of course, gave approval.
Mm-hmm.
And but before I went there, the day before, she gave me the talk.
Okay.
She said, now, when you go there, if you find some money, I don't care how far back, it could have dust on it. If it's under the couch or anywhere, don't touch it.
Right.
Because that was a way of their seeing if you were honest or not.
Yes.
They would put money. I don't care how much it was. It could be a dollar bill. It could be a quarter.
Right.
You were being judged.
Yes.
And she said, I don't care how remote it is.
Uh-huh.
Back then, that was the talk.
Oh, let me jump in on that, because you are a first person teller. I had heard that, you know, just kind of out there in the atmosphere. But so you actually had that experience. Your mom actually told you about that.
Yeah, Buddy did. Buddy told
me. I mean, Buddy. That's right. Yes. Absolutely. Too good.
Don't embarrass her. Don't touch that money. I don't care how old it looks, how remote
it was, a test.
It looks,
It was a trap. Okay, now let me remind the audience again, everybody, well, you're watching, I was just thinking, I'm your host, Norm Adams-Waite, and our guest today is Dr. Helen Benjamin and her classmate, Emma Jones-Gray. They're talking to us about this book that Dr. Benjamin edited. It's called How We Got Over, and the subtitle is Growing Up in the Segregated South, a Collection of Narratives. And so Dr. Benjamin told us about how she had an epiphany about it would have great value if she could get with her classmates, graduated in 1968 in Louisiana, from Alexandria, Louisiana school. And these narratives really tell personal experiences of what it was like to grow up under the segregation of the 60s. Now, we can imagine what your parents went through, and many of the narratives give that sideline about, you know, I grew up in this book says I grew up in the 60s, but I can imagine what my parents had to endure when they were growing up. And so this book, and we're going to tell you later before we end how to get it and everything. But now let me get back to both of you talking about your high school years. Now, the book talks a lot about, well, your years coming out of what was called Peabody High School. So, Dr. Benjamin, I'm going to ask you to tell us about, why do you think the year 1968 and the high school, Peabody High School, played so significantly as a centerpiece of the book?
Well, you know, 1968 is a pivotal year in the history of the world.
Okay, okay.
Especially in the United States.
Uh-huh.
It's the year that Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, so he was assassinated April 4th, and we were to graduate in May.
Okay.
And he had been in our hometown as a speaker in the fall of 1966.
Wow, wow.
And I have a copy of the article in the book that our local newspaper published.
Okay.
About his visit.
Okay.
At the Coliseum.
Okay.
And a couple of the contributors to the book were present, and they talk about being in that room.
Oh, wow.
So we had, you know, the class, we had a special connection to him. I think everybody feels that he or she had a special connection. But
right.
He's been in our hometown, and he was truly our drum major for justice.
Yeah.
And it was just a very, very painful kind of graduation. Mm. Our valedictorian, who happens to be married to Jean Nash Johnson, had written his speech already for graduation, but upon the death of Dr. King, he had to change that speech.
Wow.
And he still has his speech, which he references in his piece.
Okay.
But we had that to happen.
Mm.
We had all of this major unrest, the protests in the United States at the time.
Mm-hmm.
We had another assassination of Robert Kennedy later in that year.
Yes, yes. So, I think it was like August or something like that.
It was in August of 1968.
Uh-huh.
So we have all these major things happening that signal change just in the moment.
Yeah.
We're changed. We're affected by it. We don't know what the future holds. The world's just kind of upside down.
Absolutely.
And so we're getting ready to leave the cocoon of our high school, that safety of our homes, of our parents.
Uh-oh. Okay. I think we lost
that safety net.
Okay, she'll come back. We lost
her,
but she'll come back. But that safety net, go ahead.
That safety net and all these things happening in the world and facing a future that I'm sure at the time felt uncertain to us. Some of us went off to white schools, some went to black schools, some went to the military. So we're all separated.
Right.
That was a really difficult time. And so Peabody was one of the many incredible all-black schools.
Mm.
And what did we know at that time? We were about to lose as a people all that those schools offered because integration.
Give me just a little bit of a summary in your mind of how integration began, how you began to feel the impact of the loss, began to feel what you lost by integration. That was a great national thing, but what did we lose?
I think we lost so much. For one thing, we lost a lot in how it occurred.
Mm.
Because we did all the moving when it came to school integration. Anyway,
yes, yes.
We were the ones, white kids weren't bused anywhere.
Yeah.
We were the ones who left
right.
our schools to go where they were
mm-hmm.
and to be mistreated by people who did not understand us.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And so it hit me hard. I went to a black school, so
mm-hmm,
I didn't
mm-hmm.
to Bishop, to Dallas,
mm-hmm.
which was a segregated city itself.
Mm-hmm.
But I did not feel the real sting of integration until I started teaching public school in Dallas, Texas.
Wow. And how did it play out to you?
In 1971, which was the second year of the integration of schools in Dallas.
Okay.
And so they placed me in a predominantly white school.
Okay.
And the reception we got there, I could name some of the people, teachers who were there. You would know them. I am certain you would know some of them. But it appeared to me
yeah.
that they put in what we would consider our best teachers in the school.
Okay. We got to keep up that out front.
Right.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And the reception we received in those schools from the majority of those white teachers, very negative. They did not want us there.
Mm.
And at a particular school where I was assigned, children were bused in. The blacks were bused into this predominantly white, high-end school.
Yeah, yeah.
From a housing project.
Wow. That kind of gets back to what we were talking about earlier.
They had nothing in common. And these young people were separated. They started a reading program. They put in portables in the back of the school.
Wow.
And so it was just nothing like I had experienced
right.
as a high school student.
Yeah.
And I just felt for those black students.
Oh, man.
I know there was one black family lived in the neighborhood. The father was a dentist.
Mm-hmm.
So they were in regular classes.
Mm-hmm.
But the majority of those black students who were bused into that school in 1972 fall were from a housing project and set apart from those
right.
all placed in remedial classes.
Right. And I think in the book I saw several references to African Americans, our schools received reading and study materials that were secondhand sent down from other school
right.
districts.
In the South,
yeah.
absolutely. In the
mm-hmm.
South, we never got new books or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so the integration that I experienced as a teacher was to be in a school where that was supposedly integrated. It was desegregation rather than integration.
Yeah,
but
right.
There was no integration occurring. The students were still separate.
Wow.
Now, in sports, basketball, football, baseball, all of that, of course they were integrated. Their teams, sports makes a difference in the way we treat sometimes. But in terms of the same team, the treatment you receive as a part of that team is sometimes discriminatory. But there was still such a difference made. I think integration, we were still not considered to be worthy of a really good high school experience in that integrated environment with people who just didn't know us.
And again, you
had preconceived notions about us.
And again, you were talking about the 70s. This was the
70s.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay.
And so that was the first time I had been in an integrated environment on a daily basis. And
okay.
So I tried to do everything I could to make it up.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And I
now let's,
all the other black teachers there, but we were in the minority as well.
Okay. So let's see. We have Ms. Gray back, but you can't hear me? I hear you. You can't hear me. Try it again. let's see. How do I do this? Well, she's back, but she can't. Okay, she'll try it again. Okay, but let me go on. And everyone, just again, we're talking with Dr. Helen Benjamin, and we're talking about her book that she edited, How We Got Over. And basically, it's the narrative of 24 individuals, her classmates of 1968 in the town of Alexandria, Georgia. Louisiana, and it's just very telling.
So the one other thing I'd like to say, Norma, about the book is that there's some history incorporated in the book as well.
I'm gonna call.
Okay, she's telling me that she's gonna call. Okay.
So we did a lot of research.
Okay.
To establish a context for the
Let me ask you this, Dr. Benjamin. You and I had said, I talked briefly with you a couple of days ago, and I believe you had some a PowerPoint presentation or something.
I do. So we can try it. I'd love to show some of the data.
Let's try it. Let's try
okay.
it. Let's, we're going to try
share
it.
See if it pops up here.
Okay. We'll see what happens. Oh, let me get my phone here. Okay.
Can you hear me?
Okay. Yes, I can hear you. Okay.
Okay.
I can hear you, and you can hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay, good. All right. Dr. Benjamin is going to show us a brief PowerPoint.
I was trying to show it. Do you see it on the screen?
No.
Okay. All right, okay. Let me see if I can try.
And if we can't see it, do you want to just kind of explain it?
Okay. Wait, hold on a second. It did pop up.
Okay.
For a second.
All righty.
Now let me go back and see.
And let me ask both of you, do y'all mind if we go over the noon hour just a little bit?
No problem.
Okay. We're going to see if this PowerPoint will come up. Okay, now it looks like... there it is. That's it. Now let me add it to the stream. Okay, sure. There it is. Yeah.
There's a table. You see the table up there?
Yes.
We did some research because we really wanted to help people get a context for what it was like to live in the South and then how all of this started and how enslaved people... came into Louisiana anyway. So
okay.
About 500 slaves were brought into New Orleans in 1719.
Mm-hmm.
It was much later, but by 1799, when the census came up, as you can see in this table,
yeah,
it's 1799 and then 1810 and every 10 years thereafter.
Okay.
If you look at the number of whites in 1799,
mm-hmm.
there were 530, and that's in Rapides Parish. Rapides Parish. The state of Louisiana has parishes rather than counties.
Okay.
So the parish existed before the city of Alexandria did.
Ah.
So this is the whole, and a lot of, and it's all rural, colonial, really.
Mm, mm.
So in 1799, first census, and this actual census data, 530 whites,
mm-hmm.
black slaves, 175.
Okay.
Free black men, 2, for a total population in all of Rapides Parish of white slaves and free men of 706.
Mm-hmm.
What you have to understand, too, is that there were indigenous people there.
Mm-hmm.
There were Native Americans not counted in the census, though.
Okay.
Yeah.
Not counted.
So not in that one. So in 1810, 11 years later, look at those numbers.
Mm-hmm.
White 996,
mm-hmm.
black slaves 1,081,
mm-hmm.
free men 123. Let's just skip over to 1830. Look at those numbers. Whites 3,000, black slaves 5,329.
If we only knew our power.
Well, our power in those numbers. But just imagine being a slave. Being brought from Africa, across the Atlantic, up through New Orleans, and then up to central Louisiana.
Yes.
You don't even know where you are.
Not at all.
I mean, and you may not, you probably don't even know how many there are of you.
Of course not. No, no.
And so it's rural.
You know probably how many you lost in the Middle Passage, you know, maybe.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And so these are the ones who are left. They've been chained and scared to death by this time.
Mm-hmm.
So let's get to 1860.
Okay, 1860.
All the way over to the end, right before slavery.
Now, that was 100 years, roughly 100 years before your graduation, 1860s, and
that's
yours
right.
were the 1960s. Okay.
Right. So look at the numbers. Pre-Civil War.
Pre-Civil War,
1860, 9,700 whites, and look how many black slaves. Look how those numbers have grown.
My.
And then the free men numbers. So it's just, there are almost twice as many black slaves as there are white people.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Right,
and
right.
still we were enslaved. And still.
And still. And
wow.
I looked at the census numbers, the last census numbers for Alexandria.
Yeah.
Right now, my hometown.
Uh-huh.
45,000 people.
Okay.
And 55% of those are black.
More than half.
Right. Yeah. And we just got our first black mayor in 2018.
Okay. 2018, first black mayor. Is he still, let's see, 2018?
He's still in office.
Okay. Wow.
I want to go to this just to show this ad.
Oh,
so many newspapers, and I know you know this already, but there are lots of newspapers that existed in that time. We had the Louisiana, they call it Louisiana Democrat. Red River Republican, and I looked at a lot of newspapers during this time period, and this is just a typical ad that was in one of those papers. This
Negroes.
Was October of 1859.
Negroes for sale. Negroes for sale. Human beings. Wow.
Mind-blowing, isn't it?
And absolutely, absolutely.
And if you see detail from North Alabama, will be in Alexandria, Louisiana between the 15th and the 20th, 75. Boys, girls, and women.
Boys, girls, and women.
We wanted to include this information, so that people will know.
Well, let me jump in on that. And the reason why, partly from my view, that's significant, because this generation, the millennials and what have you, they probably don't want to believe it, but there it is in black and white.
It's in black and white. and one of the purposes of writing this book is not only to share the stories, but to educate people.
To
inspire people to want to know more. I spent so much time in these newspapers. I was just fascinated. I could not believe some of the things I found.
And Miss Gray, when you look at this ad, what comes to your mind and your emotions when you look at something like this in black and white? 75 Negroes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's just, you know, even to me at the grassroots levels, it's just mind blowing. But here it's authenticated our story. Everybody else want to tell our story. Right. But here's authenticated right here.
Yeah.
And so it's for anybody in all races, you know, to see. If this is what it helps do is to foster some kind of empathy.
Yes.
And foster, you know, education first, but empathy and understanding of why are people, how they came to be and why they went from just survival to thriving.
And Dr. Benjamin, in your book, I saw that quote, and I forget where it was in the book, but it has become familiar. Until the lion tells his own story, tales of the hunt will always glorify the hunter. You quote that.
That's the whole purpose for the book. We have to tell our own story from our perspectives. We're the ones who live it.
Right.
And we have allowed other people to tell our story long enough.
Yes.
And it's time for us to do our own.
Right.
So there's this kind of history, and I want to show you just one more
thing. Okay.
Now, after the Civil War, so that last census we looked at was 1860.
Okay.
And then the next census was 1870.
Hmm.
So look at those numbers.
Wow.
Whites decreased by 2,000 1,000.
Okay, okay.
Well, black slaves, zero. Why? Because the Civil War was over. South had lost. During that process of the Civil War, Louisiana and all these other southern states seceded from the Union. But after the Civil War, they wanted to come back.
Mm-hmm.
They could only come back under certain conditions.
Okay, okay.
And there were several things. They created a new constitution, and they made all kinds of promises in that constitution.
Oh, goodness.
Integrating schools,
that
slavery would be abolished, and that's why you see the zero.
On paper, on paper.
On paper, and then black free men and women. And you see in 1870, 10,000. So that black kind of reduced by 5,000.
Wow. Think about that. Think about that. Wow.
What happened to them?
Well, I'm going to guess they moved away and went to other places seeking better lives and all of that.
And looking for their families, too.
Because, yeah.
You know, there's been so much separation.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them were probably killed in the Civil War because the white men in Refuge Parish and other parts of the South went away to war. And those slaves were left there with those white women who were defending the property. But you can see that the change afterwards. And then those slaves became free and also became sharecroppers. And some worked in town. There was commerce in town, and more of them moved to town than stayed in rural areas after that because there was lots of manufacturing. There were opportunities. There was a river. There is a river that runs through Alexandria. Yep. And so because of commerce at that time anyway, there were lots of jobs. And then trees, you know, we had a lot of lumber business
there.
All that kind of related and training.
Now, is that lumbering still going? Does that still go on, lumbering?
Oh, yes, but they moved. The lumber mill has moved, the major one. I don't know a whole lot about the town, but the major one has moved to a rural area outside of town.
Okay.
They still do lots of lumber because that was one of the main economic strategies there, was to use the farming and the lumber as a result.
Thank you so much for that PowerPoint presentation. Ms. Jones, I wanted to ask you, and there is a lot of references in the book about the experience of being members of a church. What's your take, Ms. Jones, on the relationship of the home, the school, the church, the neighborhood businesses, and the social activities available for young African Americans? What's your take on how all of that played together? And then I'll ask Dr. Benjamin the same.
Yeah, and I pray that it's not an echo that you can hear.
No echo. We hear you great. Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's good. So I mentioned, of course, my home life, that was discipline, had to be, you know, my mother and father, you know, set their rules and everything. And so homework had to be done, you know, being home before the street lights came on and all of that. And of course, I broke it quite a bit, wanted to swing at the local school, and I loved to swing. And so I said, one more swing, and the next thing I know, the street light's on. So that was discipline to play each time.
You got it.
and then the church is where we went, Sunday school, 11 o'clock service, BYTU or BTU, depending on what church you went to.
Right, yeah.
And everything. And I remember you were taught disciplines in church. You weren't supposed to take communion unless you were baptized.
Okay.
And when the tray would pass by, I just saw some crackers.
I said, what's going on here? Is this dinner?
I made the mistake again and then grabbed the cracker and drink, and I got that froggy pitch again. I got that froggy
pitch. So, Dr. Benjamin, what's your take on the relationship of home, school, church, neighborhood businesses, and the social activity of the young people during that time?
Well, those were the things that saved us. And we had strong, vibrant communities at the time, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Everybody knew everybody. We looked out for each other.
Mm.
And we had our little neighborhood stores. We had churches in every community, and churches served to, as a religion, I guess, that was, not I guess, but given to us by the white man that we took and made our inspiration, I think. And if you've seen the Henry Louis Gates piece on the black church, it just, it is the thing that sustained us, I think, along with education, being able to go to school, and being in a neighborhood where everybody knew you, understood you, cared about you more than anything else.
Right.
And that's what we lost with integration.
Mm.
And I think that's been detrimental.
Yes.
Mm. So although we've been successful in some ways, that lost in integration caused us to not advance in ways we should, kind of tore up our communities in ways they had.
It pulled the rug out from under us.
Those things during segregation were what sustained us, inspired us. Black church just gave us, the most used word right now is hope.
Hope. Mm.
If you have hope, if you just have just a glimmer of it, you can make it the next day. And so that's that how I got over. She's talking about what she sees and what she's going to do, what she's going to thank God when she sees him. That's the hope. That's the future.
Yeah.
And that's what our communities gave us with all those different pieces of the church, the school, the home, was hope.
Right.
Without hope, there's nothing. There's no reason to live. But regardless of what was happening to us on a daily basis, those institutions helped us to maintain hope.
Hope. Now, Dr. Benjamin, when you look at the fact that you actually did accomplish this book, I mean, it started out as a concept in your mind, and now we can hold it up and actually look at it. So when you think that I did it, you know, you can say I did it, what makes you proud about it, about having accomplished this feat?
Well, I don't say I did it.
Okay.
I had an idea. It took. You know, this is the whole village concept. It's we did it.
There's
no way I could have done all of that by myself.
The village concept.
All of these people, unnamed people. People I didn't even thank in the acknowledgments because there were just so many people to thank. But it was definitely a group effort. And it's kind of like, I mean, you finish a major project, and I guess, I think I just say mission accomplished. And I say mission accomplished because it has made so many people happy. And especially in our hometown, we had a book signing here at the public library.
Okay.
One we couldn't go to. And the library, I have to say, our Rapid Search Library, the director there, everybody was just so helpful. But people came that day. They bought books. We had people like, I never been to a book signing before.
Yeah,
and people are in our communities, in our churches here. We've had groups, and I'm in Alexandria today. That's what I'm saying.
Okay.
So we've had groups speak at churches, at our high school, at a middle school, and people have embraced the book. They want copies of it. They bought books. And so that's why I say mission accomplished, because if we don't sell another book to anybody else, people at home see themselves in it.
Great. And Miss Gray, what is your take on having been a part of this? What makes you proud about having been a part of this effort?
Right. It's just, it's just so exhilarating just to be part of a historical body of work, first of all, and to do it with my fellow classmates. A secret, I wasn't even supposed to be in the class of 68.
Oh, how so?
My mom came to me when I was in my junior, had just entered middle school.
Yeah.
And my two siblings behind me, there was no babysitter, and we fell on hard times, and she needed someone to babysit. There was no preschool and all of that.
Right.
And so she asked me in tears, would I forego my junior, my entering in middle school, just to babysit until she gets her, you know, get better financially.
Right.
And I told her yes. And so the next year, I wind up being, and thus the class of 68.
Wow. That's really, that's a revealing life story. That's a revealing life story. And I'm asking both of you, I may have this wrong, but let me just ask, was there at some point, maybe toward the end, where, or even throughout the process, where the contributors came together, and I wonder what was that like? Were there heated debates about, no, I don't remember that. No, it wasn't there. It was at the corner. Were there any type of experiences like that? I'll start with Dr. Benjamin and then you, Ms. Gray.
We did this during the pandemic.
Okay.
All of our meetings were on Zoom.
Okay, okay.
And so in our first meeting, it was a bit of a reunion because we were talking about different things that happened. And
okay.
Did you remember this, or did you remember that Dr. King came? Or we were just kind of pulling it all together.
Right, so right.
Those meetings were like, and I didn't know the story Emma just told until we in one of those meetings.
Yes.
Shared that with us. I thought she came with us from first grade, just about everybody. We all came up from first grade together. She would have been in class of 67. So we now know that we have we're just happy to have her, that she's, not that that happened to her, but she ended up with us, and that's wonderful.
Right. And both of you talked a little bit about it, but I want to ask, education, I mean, you know, it seems throughout the book, education. So I'll start with Ms. Gray. Do you feel that we as African-Americans still have that sense of respect, I guess, for education? Or if not, what was different then about wanting an education as compared to today? And then I'll hear from Dr. Benjamin.
Yeah, I believe our parents wanted us to, you know, to do better than what they did.
Okay.
And that's a legacy of any parent, want your children to do better. Education was stressed in my home. One child would help the other if you had a difficult subject, and that was just a must. The child should help the younger and everything like that.
Right.
And so I came from a family of six, and so I thank God that all of us at least went on to, if not to a higher education, at least you had some kind of vocational, some kind of skill.
Okay.
Engineer to social worker. And I went back after raising my two sons in California.
Uh-huh.
I went back and got my bachelor's at age 55. I was so determined.
Hush. Oh my gosh. That's impressive.
Because I was stopping and going.
Yeah.
And I built up enough credits to go right on. And so it's never too late.
And I
can hear my parents' voice. Education. So it's very important. You want to do better.
Let me just repeat what I heard you say. You said you went back and got further education at age 55 or so, and you said throughout, I could hear my parents' voice, education.
Yes.
Wow. Is that, Dr. Benjamin, is that still real today or is it different now?
I know that it was real for us because our parents just knew that was the only way to get out.
Yeah.
They saw that as the key to getting out.
Yeah.
I think it's true today for a lot of families,
mm-hmm.
but because of the way the world has changed, mm-hmm. there are different options for people.
Okay.
You've got technical schools. There are some majors. Students can now go for 2 years and get, if they're in certain technology fields.
Yeah, right.
And earn as much money as somebody who gets a bachelor's degree.
I
think it's still important.
Right.
The delivery is different now.
Okay.
People have just so many different options.
Mm-hmm.
Within the Black community, I wonder, I don't know, that's, I haven't read much research on it. I think that integration has had an impact on how young people react because everybody that we went to school with heard about education,
uh-huh.
how vital it was,
uh-huh.
but everybody didn't pursue higher education.
Well, the basis you called, babe.
And I think it's still true for today that everybody does not pursue it. They're aware of it. Mm. But they have more.
The battery is about to go out.
We're getting ready to wind down, but two things as we begin to close out. Can you still hear me, Ms. Gray?
Yes, I
can. Okay. First of all, let me go ahead right now and ask Dr. Benjamin to tell the audience how you can get the book, and then I want us to swing back a little bit, and I want to hear any part of this discussion that we did not cover that you want to revisit. So let's start with the audience. How do you get the book? And the book is How We Got Over Growing Up in the Segregated South, A Collection of Narratives. And Ms. Gray is one of the contributors of the book and a classmate of Dr. Benjamin from the 1968 class of Alexandria, Louisiana, and it was very segregated, and all of those experiences of having to live with one person had the railroad track right at their back door, and all of the undesirable things of a community right there, but we got over. We got over. So tell us, Dr. Benjamin, how can you get the book?
It's pretty simple, Amazon.com.
There we have it. There we have it. Go to Amazon.com and type in, of course, the name of the book, I guess. Type in the name of the book. I'm sorry?
Yes, the name of How We Got Over or Benjamin, either one comes up.
Okay, either type in Dr. Benjamin's name, which is Dr. Helen Benjamin. She is the editor of the book. She and co-editor Jean Nash Johnson, who is married to Dr. Benjamin and Ms. Gray's classmate, and I think he has a narrative in the book as well. So go to Amazon.com, either type in Dr. Helen Benjamin or type in the name of the book, How We Got Over, based on that song, How I Got Over, that and Mahalia Jackson, and the other singer.
Aretha Franklin,
Cara Ward, yes. How I Got Over, and that song is so telling, and the narratives in this book are very telling. So let me start with Dr. Benjamin, and then we'll go to Ms. Gray. Any parts of this discussion that we didn't get to or that you really feel like you want to mention, beginning with Dr. Benjamin?
No, I think we pretty much covered it. The historical parts are very important. We talk about enslavement, what it was like in Louisiana, how slaves got there, what their lives were like, the separate but unequal parts of our lives. And there's a piece on the history of education in Alexandria, Peabody High School,
okay,
which is really insightful into the two men over 70 years responsible for the public education of black students in Alexandria.
Oh,
and
my
one
goodness.
Of those men was our principal, and his daughter, Gwen Isles, lives in Dallas, Texas.
Really?
But her father, Professor Isles, Professor David Isles, was our principal. And then the founder of the school was J.B. LaFarge. Those two men for 70 years.
Wow.
They had the roadmap. They had such an influence. We owe so much to both of them.
Oh, wow.
What they did for African Americans.
Oh,
wow. And so there's a chapter there about them.
Okay.
And then we talk about the civil rights movement and an attorney, a black attorney who studied under Thurgood Marshall at Howard University.
Okay.
Yes, Lewis Berry.
Okay.
And we pay tribute to his bravery and his courage.
Absolutely.
In helping, because Emma was a benefactor of his civil rights work. She was the first African American to work for the Sheriff's Department in a kind of civilian position.
Tell us a little bit, Ms. Gray, as you talk about any topics that you feel you would like to bring up that we didn't talk about, and then tell us about you being a benefactor of this wonderful gentleman.
Yes. Yes, it did. Yes, I just wanted to mention, too, to emphasize, too, that a lot of time when my friends and family want to look for the book, they say how I got over. The emphasis is how we got over.
Very good point. Okay. How we got over. The song,
yeah.
How I Got Over. But the book, because it encompasses the experiences of the whole class, and as Dr. Benjamin pointed out, us as a people,
right.
Not just
absolutely.
An individual or a class, but us as a people, how we
absolutely.
Got over. Okay, but go on.
And to answer your question,
mm-hmm.
What Helen alluded to with Attorney Lewis Berry, I had gone to, even though I went later on and got my bachelor's, right after high school, parents couldn't afford to send several of us to college. They already have two in college. So I opted to go to vocational. I went to Alexandria Trade School, I think they called it at the time, and got a certificate in secretarial science.
Okay.
And so just as everything was opening up for civil rights, as she mentioned, Attorney Lewis Berry was part of the civil rights movement. And so he searched around to see, can he find someone? The sheriff department was opening up. And so he searched through the community, and I was recommended.
Okay.
I had finished high in my studies and everything. And so they opened up the sheriff department to African Americans. I saw some black sheriffs that they had opened it up to, but they didn't have anybody work in the administrative part.
Okay.
And so because I had gone to secretarial science, I was awarded after interviewing, of course.
Right.
And everything, the sheriff at the time, Sheriff Capel, he offered me the job, and of course I took it. Worked for two detectives.
Were you petrified as a first to hold
yes.
that position? Were you just really petrified or what?
You know, they were welcoming. And
okay.
I had no problem.
Okay.
They were more fascinated. You know, I guess because they had not worked with the African American.
Exactly.
Before.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. So they were more. I was confident in what I was doing.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the detective, when they went, it was almost like Dragnet. If you go back and look at Dragnet, it was like that. I had to record when a crime happened and file the rap sheets and all of that and take dictation. And the detective was so enamored by me taking dictation, he could hardly do his...
And she can take dictation, too?
Yes, she can do this, too. I crossed my legs and was doing it at the same time.
Oh, my gosh.
And at the time, he said, okay, Ms. Jones. I said, you go on, Detective Bolden. I got you.
Oh, my gosh.
So
good,
it was just a lovely experience, though.
Very good.
Yeah, they gave me an opportunity, and they see that we're not inferior.
Yes.
And we can do the job.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes. Now, Dr. Benjamin, I also wanted you to tell, if someone in the audience, either viewing or listening, wants to reach you, is there an email? Now, we can put this in the chat, and we will put it in the chat. What's your best suggestion for how to reach you, your email, or is there a phone number or a website? We already told Amazon.com,
right.
But how do we reach you? What do you prefer, Dr. Benjamin?
We have all those mechanisms. So the easiest would be H. Benjamin, the number one, at yahoo.com.
Okay. Okay. We're putting that in the chat. H for Helen, Benjamin being the last name, BENJAMIN, the numeral one, at
yahoo.com.
Okay. That's the email. Very good. So that's the best way to get
yes.
you. Very good. Very good. All righty. I think we have revisited Alexandria, Louisiana, gone back to the land, gone back in a parental history and certainly the history of our people. I've truly enjoyed the visit, and I look forward to everyone getting this book. how we got over. Oh, and I wanted to say that you see the cover. Tell us real quickly, Dr. Benjamin, about this cover illustration.
Okay. I was talking to a graphic designer. I was having lunch with her, actually, one day. That was when I was in Santa Barbara and last summer. And I was telling her about my neighborhood, and she just said, I'll tell you what I see. And that it turned out to be the cover.
Okay.
Okay. She works at UC Santa Barbara in the graphics department.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then I think there's also inside.
Yeah, she did a lot.
Yeah.
The back and
yeah.
then the inside.
And the inside shows the, let me see if I can put it up, shows the railroad tracks. I don't think I can
yes.
show it too well, but.
Yes.
You can see the railroad track. All right,
yes.
My wonderful guests, thank you all so much. And
we will
say adios and have a great day.
All right.
Okay. All right. Bye-bye. Okay. Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. How we got over. And we had a lot to overcome. And you, the audience, you have your own stories of how you got over and the obstacles that your families came through. And Miss that touched me, what Miss Gray was talking about, how she had a couple of close calls for how she could have left the planted when she was about four. I think one she was about four, another one she was around six or so. And she was playing with matches and her hair caught fire. She could have been gone, but she survived it. Another experience she talked about, getting on the town bus and thinking she could just sit down on the front and sitting there looking at the driver, and the driver would not take off because he saw this little African-American girl sitting at the front of the bus. He didn't say anything, but her mother immediately came up and grabbed her and pinched her and dragged her to the back. And only years later did young Miss Gray, young Emma, who is now Miss Gray, Miss Jones Gray, only in years later did she put two and two together as to why did Mama drag me from the front of that bus, you know? So many experiences and working hard work on the land and how it sustained our families during that time, and all the different crops and what have you that the families had to sharecroppers. And you know, sharecroppers were paid very small, very, very hard labor, very, very small money, but they survived it. They got over, and here they are telling their stories in all of these narratives today, and we are fortunate to be able to read them. Now, we want to talk a little bit about some of the things going on in the community, and let's see, let's just start a couple of months away. We can start wondering who's going to get the Quest for Success honors. That's coming up with the Dallas Black Chamber of Commerce in a couple of months. So if you own a business or whatever, you can begin to look into that. And it celebrates African-American entrepreneurs and non-profit leaders in the Dallas and Fort Worth area. So that's coming up in a couple of months. So contact the Dallas Black Chamber of Commerce, and this will be the 38th annual Quest for Success. So see if you can get in on that. And we want to mention that the William Blair Park cleanup was supposed to have been sometime this week, I think, but it has been rescheduled. And we know that the William Blair Park is named for the founder of Elite News newspaper and a Negro baseball pitcher, William Blair, outstanding local Dallas person. And a park is named for him in the far South Dallas area known as Bon-Ton. And each year, it's 3,000 municipal street, zip code 75215. And it's Blair Park, William Blair Park. So the cleanup in that area has been rescheduled for March 19. It had been originally set, I think it was this week, and it starts at 9 a.m. And so I'm prepared to come to that. Now let me look at some of the other things here. Okay, there is a survey being conducted by attorney Louis Bedford IV, along with State Senator Royce West. And they are creating a short survey asking citizens about their voting experiences during the recent March 1 primary election. They want to know, how do you feel the process was handled? Were there some issues that you had? How could the whole process be improved? Do you feel it worked fairly well? And the results will be shared with Dallas County election officials to improve the process. And so you can contact the offices of Attorney Louis Bedford and Senator Royce West to find out how you can give them, how you can respond to the survey. Now, here is a class that you can always use these digital career courses, but this is a free digital career course, and it's at the St. Philip's We Creation Center on Colonial Street in South Dallas, 3016 Colonial. And it's a free course. A Goodwill Industry is partnering with the We Creation Center, which is part of St. Philip's School there in South Dallas. And you can learn basic computer skills. You can learn introduction to Microsoft Word. You can learn to use Excel. And it's free. It's free. And it's particularly free to people with disabilities. It's free to young people and senior adults. And it's free to formerly incarcerated people, people who have served time locked up. known as second chances. And I'm going to give you a site where you can register for it, and there's also a phone number. So register at Academy at Goodwill Dallas, all of that together, Academy at goodwilldallas.org. That's the email that you can register. Or here's a phone number you can call for Kim Coleman, 214-638-2800, extension 152. Now, here's another class for senior adults. And this one is presented through the Senior Source Agency on Harry Hind. And it's free. It's free. It's free. It's free. So this one, it takes a little bit of a comical twist in promoting this. And it says you can turn the tables. You can turn the tables on your grandkids, and you can teach them what you have learned about all this technology going on. So this session for senior adults shows you how to use the messaging app on your phone. Now, that's no small thing. I mean, if you can learn the messaging app on your phone and you haven't really had those experiences before, that's an achievement. So the classes will be offered April 7 and April 21. And it's co-sponsored by AARP, Now, and you can call the Senior Source to get more information. Now, here is a registration site, www.seniorplanet. That's the word senior and the word planet, like the planet we live on, all run together, www.seniorplanet.org/senior source. Now, Senior Source, of course, is one of the sponsors. So again, you can register at www.seniorplanet.org/senior source. And this one is kind of interesting. And again, I want to thank Ken Smith, who is with he's with Revitalized South Dallas Coalition, and they put out this information to the community about every month or so, every week or so, several times a month. So we want to thank Revitalized South Dallas Coalition, headed by Ken Smith, and he's giving us this information. And one of the other items is that the Dallas Park and Recreation is having a hiring event, and it is March 25 from 8:30 a.m. to 4 p.m. Now, you can go there at Fair Park. It's in the Briscoe Carpenter Center in Fair Park. Now, you go in through gate 3. Go in through gate 3 at Fair Park anytime between 8:30 a.m. to 4 p.m. on March 25. Now, gate 3, you enter it at 1400 Washington. And the Dart Green Line can take you there. And so they are looking for full and part-time workers. And here are some of the positions that you can apply for. Maintenance workers, recreation center assistants, the Fresh Start program is offering various positions. There are customer service positions. You can be a lifeguard. You can be a crew leader through Park and Recreation. You can help with concessions. You can be a concessionaire. You can even be a summer camp leader. So go to this event. Masks are required. Masks are required. And here's a phone number if you want to call, 214-671-9835. That's a phone number you can call, 214-671-9834. Those are some good events. Now, here's one. There is, for the Dallas Black Chamber of Commerce, tomorrow, from noon to one, they're having a virtual orientation for new members. So it would be good to go to that. And so www.DallasBlackTxCOC. So that's the website, or you can call the Dallas Black Chamber to get in on their new member orientation. Now, this next event has been around for a while, but it's such an, I think it's a neat idea. It's called Together We Dine. And it's a dining experience. Now, for COVID for a while took it offline, and they found a way for you to be online virtually to dine together. You could essentially have your own meal, and everybody was having their meal, and you could have these really intriguing conversations while you dined on your own meal. But now it's back together. It's live again. It's live again. So so it's Together We Dine, and it's a dining event to facilitate courageous and safe conversations about, guess what, race and diversity. And it's all ethnic groups, all races of people can participate in these conversations. And you can speak your mind, give your opinions, listen to the viewpoint of folk from different races than your own. And so the date is March 29. And the time is 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. And here is the location. The location is the Dialogue Institute, Dallas. Dialogue, D-I-A-L-O-G-U-E, Dialogue Institute, Dallas. And here's the address. It's in Richardson. It's 1416 East Collins Boulevard in Richardson. I'll give that to you again. It's at the Dialogue Institute, Dallas, 1416 East Collins Boulevard in Richardson. So the information says that they invite you to talk about race and race relations, diversity on this date and during the Together We Dine. And state your mind. And these are total strangers that you'll be with. But hopefully by the end of the evening and the wonderful meal that you're going to share, you'll no longer be total strangers. Now, each table is led by a facilitator, and participants will engage in healthy and structured dialogue. You can't just go off on a tangent and shut everybody out. It would be structured dialogue, and the facilitator will facilitate. And it's designed to build relationships and to build trust with people who are different than yourself. It's free. Space is limited, and you register online, and you have to register by March 22nd. And here are some of the, it's three main hosts. The Dallas Bar Association is one of the hosts. Project Unity is one of the hosts. And as I said, Dallas Dialogue Institute is a host. Now, again, it's an in-person event, March 29. That's a Tuesday, March 29 from 6 to 8, and it's at Dallas Dialogue Institute Dallas, 1416 East Collins Boulevard in Richardson. So if you go online and type in Together We Dine, the registration tab will come up. Go online, type in Together We Dine, and the registration tab will come up. Now, this one is kind of, this is a good one here. T-Ball, the Academy, Black Academy of Arts and Letters, the Black Academy of Arts and Letters is sponsoring a writer's breakfast. And guess who are featured speakers at this roundtable writer's breakfast that they have periodically? Irma P. Hall and Regina Taylor, very respected names in movie making and theater. Irma P. Hall, and she's a Dallas legend, and Regina Taylor as well. They both are. They are critically acclaimed actresses, and they will discuss, they will have give their insightful views about their experiences, their challenges, and the ongoing neglect regarding Black theater in America. We're just not giving Black theater the attention it deserves, and they're going to talk about it. They know about it. They've lived it. They know about it. So the topic is the relevance of Black theater in American cultural mainstream. The relevance of Black theater in American cultural mainstream. So we want to hear about that. And there, I was looking for, there is another theater event. I think I have misplaced that information. I may run across it as I go on. But let me tell you about this training that's focusing on how to grow your business. Now, this is and $1,000 is awarded to the top participant. Now, here's the deal on this. The Zan Wesley Holmes Jr. Community Outreach Center. It's offering a free training session to small and startup businesses because they want to help them grow their business. The top participant who completes the program will be awarded $1,000. Now, other participants will also receive $750 for business legal aid and also $300 for the entity incorporation if needed. And they will have the opportunity to present their business proposal to potential investors. Now, the initiative is funded in part by the Muse Family Foundation, which has provided funding for the technical assistance program. Now, this free training will present best practices in business planning, accounting. It will talk about cash flow management. It will talk about business taxes, about marketing, about social media, and more than that. Now, it's a 12-week period, 1 3-hour session per week. And it provides ongoing mentorship as well. Now, here are the requirements. You have to own a business or plan to relocate to the area of 75210 or 75215. There's no physical store. You don't have to have a physical store or a space. You must be a product-based company and have pop-up stores. Now, the service-based company must hire within those two zip codes, 75210 and 75215. The application period is March 14 through April 1st. Now, orientation is April 25, with sessions beginning as Zoom sessions on April 27. Now, if you want to know more or if you want to apply, here's the site, www. Now, these initials are for Zan Wesley Holmes Jr., Community Outreach Center. So you take the first letter of each word, www.zwhjcoc.org. And then when it comes open, you can click events and class, and you can get in on that way. JBJ Management is another item. They have announced that they have hired a former Dallas city manager on their staff, and he is AC Gonzalez. So he's now works as part of the JBJ Management team. And of course, we know Willis Johnson, a very prominent former radio personality. He's the CEO of JBJ Management, and they have accomplished a lot of things in the Dallas area since Willis Johnson left being a radio personality. Now, I love this next item. The next item, you remember the Cummings Recreation Center right there near Bonnie View and Loop 12? It was called for many, many years the Cummings Recreation Center. Well, guess what the new name is going to be? It's going to be Hiawatha Williams Recreation Center. And we know that Hiawatha Williams is the founder and owner of Williams Chicken. Yummy, 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 yummy. I love their fried fish, too. Hiawatha, it's going to be Hiawatha Williams Recreation Center. So if you go over there looking for Cummings Recreation Center, you're not going to find it. You will find Hiawatha Williams. Now, the Dallas Park Board voted to rename Cummings Recreation Center in honor of Hiawatha Williams, and we are thrilled about it. He's not only is he this outstanding business personality, but he's a great philanthropist. I mean, he just reaches out to the community in so many ways, so many ways. So he could not be more deserving, couldn't be more deserving. And we're just so happy for him. So, of course, now the Dallas Black Dance Theater on March 6th is having an event. It's at the Eisman, I hope I'm saying that correctly, E-I-S-E-M-A-N-N, Eisman Center, Richardson. And you can get tickets online. It's called Aqua, Dancing Young Waters North, and it's March 26th. But stay tuned with the Dallas Black Dance Theater, because they're just always putting on just absolutely wonderful, wonderful events. Now, also, April 2nd, here's one that we're getting ready to wind down, but on April 2nd, this is a Saturday, it's called Evolution of Worship, these wonderful gospel singers, God Bolt, CC God Bolt, Carolyn Trail, and Mark Ayers Jr. will participate in what's called Evolution of Worship. It's a concert, Evolution of Worship, and it's April 2nd at 6 p.m. You can get your tickets at www.eventbrite.com, but go to Eventbrite. Go to Eventbrite and type in Evolution of Worship Concert. Here it is. ANFCA, I think it is. ANFChurch.org. That's it. ANFChurch.org. It's kind of hard to read, but it's All Nations Fellowship. That's the name of the church, All Nations Fellowship. But you can go to Eventbrite and just type in Evolution of Worship. It's going to be a wonderful concert, April 2nd at 6 p.m. featuring CC Godboat, Carolyn Traylor, and Mark Ayers. So it's about time for us to get out of here, and we're going to listen to Teddy Pendergrass. Oh, I did want one other thing real quickly. We know this is Women's History Month, and the Regional Black Contractors Association have picked Margot Posey as the featured woman in their women's history feature. And she is president and CEO of the Dallas-Fort Worth Minority Supplier Development Council. Now, she's been in business for quite a while, doing a lot in relationship with National Minority Suppliers Development Council. And her work has been highly ranked nationally several times. And she was elected the NWSDC peer president as their chair, representing the affiliate council of the NMSDC group. And she's just an outstanding businesswoman, so we wanted to be sure to tell you about her being picked. So let me see if I can find our guy, Mr. Pendergrass. Let me just see if I can find him. And of course, now we don't own the rights to this song, but it's Wake Up Everybody, and the message is so important. So if we can get some of the message from Teddy Pendergrass, as he tells us to wake up, everybody. Wake up. Wake up, wake up, wake up. No more sleeping. No more sleeping in bed. It's time to move ahead. And I hope we can still hear him. He's singing. I don't know if you can hear him. I hope you can. Time to think ahead. World has changed so very much. What it used to be. There's so much hatred, war, and poverty. I hope you can hear Teddy. Let's see what else he has to say. Wake up the teachers. Time to teach a new way. Maybe the students will listen to what you have to say. They're the ones who are coming up. The world in their hands. But when you teach the children, teach them the best way you can. They are important. The world won't get any better. No, no. If we just let it be, turn our heads, look the other way, act like we don't see anything. The world will not. We got to change it. Just you and me.
Make the old people well. They're the ones who suffer and catch all the hair. They don't have so very long before their judgment day. Won't you make them happy before they pass away? Wake up all the builders, time to build a new land. I know we could do it if we all lend a hand. The only thing we have to do